Welcome to Heartbeat of Humanity, a podcast series for staff and volunteers in the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, working with mental health and psychosocial support services. My name is Jesper Gule, and I'm a communications officer working for the IFSC Reference Center for Psychosocial Support. According to UNHCR, more than 100 million people are forcibly displaced worldwide, and 36 million are children below the age of 18 years. It is easy to imagine what devastating consequences it can have on a child's well-being to be forced on the move. The question is, what can we as humanitarians do to support these children? How can we create a safe environment for them and help them cope adequately with their situation and strengthen their resilience and protect their mental health and psychosocial well-being? That's the topic of this podcast, and to get an answer to this complex question, I have interviewed four people with professional insight into the matter. The first person I talked to was Orso Munigina, also is head of the Global Program Expert Group on Mental Health and Psychosocial Support in SOS Children's Villages International, and I invited him to talk about the EPSOM project, a two-year EU-funded project supporting refugee children to cope adequately with difficulties and to socialize with other kids in order to prevent mental health problems. But before I asked Orso to introduce the EPSOM project, I asked him to explain what we already know about adversity and children on the move.
We do actually know quite a lot from both research and practice, and we know that forced migration can place severe distress on children on the move, and in particular on unaccompanied children. This happening during all stages of the migration, that is, before, during, and after arrival. We also know that children and adolescent psychosocial and mental health needs are often not identified. This is actually a global problem. And WHO is estimating that at the global level, more than 80% of children do not actually receive adequate mental health care. This obviously causes long-term consequences, which are very serious, including the intergenerational transmission of trauma, that is, trauma that gets passed from those that are actually experiencing an incident or a traumatic event to their subsequent generation. So it's something that lasts very long in time.
So what should we do? What can we do?
Okay, there are other things that we know that can help us. And also, because when we look at these perspectives from a European point of view, we see the numbers of refugee children suffering from some form of emotional behavioral disorders are very high. And we know that uncertainty is one of the many, I would say, hallmarks in many respects of the refugee experience. So we know that all efforts should really try to minimize this. And we also know that despite these incredible hardships that many children are undergoing, sometimes arriving to Europe takes more than 1 year, the majority of individuals, including unaccompanied children, if they are provided with adequate and immediate support, will react positively and will not require mental health services. This is a very important information for us. What we know, though, is that all of them will have to deal with what we call daily stressors, that is, those challenges of day-to-day living, which can be either predictable or unpredictable, like finding a job, integrating into the community, living also with the memories of what has happened so far. And if we look at the life of children on the move in Europe, especially those arriving unaccompanied, these daily stressors are very numerous and quite serious. One example, for instance, is the uncertainty about the asylum seeking procedure, being moved from one shelter to the other, lack of privacy and living in very overcrowded housing spaces, and so on and so forth. So there are many policies and initiatives at the international level that now is more than a decade have been offering tools and guidelines on how we can actually provide support and services to population in emergencies, including those in forced migration. And I know, because you have been talking about this also in other podcasts, the ISCC guidelines on MHPSS in emergencies, for instance, is one of those, and one of those which has been mostly used. what these guidelines are telling us is that it's not enough for basic needs such as shelter, food, or education to be provided. This is, of course, essential. But it's also fundamental that psychosocial, psychological and social emotional needs are also identified and addressed from the very start of an emergency. And I would say that in connection to EPSUM and TMAP, because of the focus we chose in this program, we also know from several studies and research that movement-based activities can really be effective, not only to relieve stress and tension, but also to help children reconnect or connect with their peers, even without the use of speech, which is an element which is quite important in the kind of emergencies we are talking about. Moreover, we know that nonverbal activities such as TMAP, which is the interventions that we are promoting in this project that I will tell you more about, which is called EPSUM, can stimulate what is called neuroplasticity, that is the ability of the brain to recover and restructure and strengthen also those resources, both physiological and psychological, which are very important for a child to maintain and restore their own well-being.
So also, before you go on, please tell us more about EPSUM and the kind of interventions you're proposing within the EPSUM.
Absolutely. Well, in a nutshell, EPSUM is a project co-funded by the European Union, where SOS Children's Village is international through SOS Italy and SOS Greece in particular, as partner with World Child in the Netherlands, Centro Pench in Italy, Refugees Welcome and Save the Children in Sweden, to basically support and accompany children in coping with the difficulties they encounter when they arrive in Europe, such as how to deal with their emotions, how to help them socialize with other kids, how to prevent further mental health or psychosocial problems. It is a project that we started in 2019 and was supposed to finish at the end of 2020, but obviously, because of COVID-19, activities have been not just delayed, but actually adapted and extended until the end of 2023. And we will have our final conference just in a few days on the 15th of December, where the main outcomes of the project will be shared and discussed. During this past 3 years, I would say, we have worked with professional volunteers in the reception systems in Italy, in Greece and in Sweden in particular, to integrate within existing services provided to young refugees, an intervention which has been developed by World Child in the Netherlands, which is called TMAP, and which has been used extensively and with success before. And since then, actually, we are using TMAP also in other countries beyond Europe, and not only as SOS Children's Villages, but also the other organizations involved in the project. So basically, we applied this intervention within TMAP, within EPSUM, because we wanted to see whether it was possible to replicate this practice in different contexts and whether it was possible to verify not only its effectiveness, but also its scalability and adaptability to different reception system contexts.
So also tell me a little bit more about TMAP. How does a TMAP session work?
Okay. So I will give you first some basic elements, some key characteristics of what TMAP is. So as we said already, it's a movement-based intervention. It's a group intervention whose main aim is that one of improving emotional and physical well-being. The methodology, in fact, consists of promoting a wide variety of activities which are based on play, sport, creative movement, and body awareness. There are also elements, for instance, of yoga and mindfulness that you will find in these interventions. It's what we might call a universal preventative psychosocial support intervention. And I saw in other podcasts, you have already extensively talked about the ISCC pyramid. So this basically is an intervention which is targeting community and family support and which is in principle useful and appropriate for a very large number of individuals, in this case, children between 6 and 17 years old, were undergoing some forms of serious adversity, such as forced migration can be. A team-up session usually lasts 1 hour and is carried out with a certain frequency, which has to be regular, ideally at least once every week. And other elements of connected with this, that there should be the same time, the same face, and the same location. And this is to reduce the sense of uncertainty and reestablish a sense of normalcy and routine that very often is not present in the life of young refugees arriving in Europe or in other contexts. What makes TEAMUP a psychosocial intervention is that each activity proposed has a specific goal related to an emotional or psychosocial team. There are 8 teams all in all, and I could also tell you more about it later. And another element which I think is very important is its nonverbal approach. So most of the activities are conducted and followed by children through the principle of learning by doing, playing, and moving. And these characteristics is very important because it allows us to work with a population that have just arrived in Europe, don't speak local language, and it will take otherwise much longer for us to be able to involve them in our activities. Another key element in terms of scalability is the fact that these interventions can be delivered by so-called lay professionals, meaning people, volunteers or staff already in a healing relationship, already working with children, but not having mental health or psychosocial background, not being specialists in this area.
And how did you embed TEAMUP with Epson?
This is a very interesting question. Thanks for that. So we have actually trained 10 master trainers and over 90 professionals from each of the country, the 3 countries involved in the project, on the TEAMUP methodology. And during the course of the projects, we have also reached around 380 unaccompanied migrant minors living in Italy, Greece, and Sweden. And we have worked directly, in particular in Italy and Greece, with also reception centers to see how the interventions could be adapted to the specific needs of the countries and the specific needs also of the population arriving there. TEAMUP is an effective intervention for children on the move. We know that. There are also is an evidence-based intervention. But there are some elements which are fundamental for us to be able to replicate it in other contexts. And some of these elements, for instance, are the need for a mentoring support for the facilitators and also a strong focus on self-care. To give an example, when relying on volunteers, for instance, teachers, we have been working also in schools, it's very important to consider the additional workload that an intervention like TEAMUP will impose on them. And also to consider this when you want to implement an activity like this in their own routine or normal activities they carry out. Equally, because an important element of TEAMUP is the possibility of detecting possible instances of suffering which require specialized support. When you carry out a TEAMUP session, I told you before about these 8 teams, you work on teams, for instance, fear, and you can observe specific skills or behavior that the child is manifesting that can tell you how this child is actually doing. So, for instance, in relation to the team of fear, is he able to ask for help? Is he able to use self-soothing techniques or to name the emotions he's feeling or she's feeling and recognize it in the body? These are all important skills for a child. And if this is not happening, the facilitator is trained on how to detect these, let's say, problems or possible problems and how to refer them for further support. But this, of course, if there is not an initial planning before implementing TMAP, can cause an overload or workload on the referral systems that in some cases is very fragile. So this is another element that we have noticed is very important. And finally, I think, as in many other interventions that we are promoting in the field, it's very important also to involve the people that have experiencing the, in this case, for instance, forced migration. So you can have as facilitators people with a refugee background, also people from the location where you actually implement the activity. And this is a way to involve communities, but also to ensure that contextualization and relevance of the intervention is really taken into account.
That is so interesting. Thank you very much also for telling us about the TMAP and EPSOM.
Thanks to you for inviting us.
That was also Monegina introducing EPSOM and TMAP. In my next interview, I will move back into the Red Cross Red Crescent movement because I thought it would be interesting to hear what services national societies provide to create safe environments for children in migration and what challenges they face. Therefore, the next person I spoke to was Christel Voldby Winter, Program Manager of Mental Health in the Migration and Refugee Section in the National Department of Danish Red Cross. And my first question to her was, how does Danish Red Cross work with refugee children and their mental health?
Danish Red Cross, we have a migration and refugee section, and we work with children and their mental health through our local branches. So in Denmark, we have 108 local branches where we work with refugees. And that means that we actually cover quite a lot of Denmark because we have refugees living in different municipalities. So we work with the children and their families in these local branches. And it's kind of funny because for many years we have mainly been working with the adults and the male refugees coming to Denmark, especially because of the Syrian war that that made often, obviously, a lot of the males coming to Denmark before their wives and their children came. So we have actually seen quite a lot of changes in the way that we work with refugees within the last year. We always work with protecting the children. So we make sure that the volunteers have a children certificate, that they are obviously ready to protect the children, that they have been no criminal offenses or so on. But now we are also focusing more specifically on how to work with the children to make sure that they are being supported and that they are thriving in Denmark while they're here. So we work with the families, but now we're also working more with the children. Especially we are trying to make awareness to the volunteers so that they are ready to protect the children when they see them. And especially also that they are ready to handle the reactions that they might see with the children because they have been through so many things.
And can you tell a little bit more specifically about the programs you have working with children and their mental health?
Yeah. We have a program that we call Calm Together, and we have developed this program to make sure that the volunteers have knowledge and tools to handle the children that they meet in their social activities. Calm Together is obviously about being calm together. So the material is focusing very much on the relation between the adults in the family and the children. We know that the family is the core to make sure that the children are safe and calm and that they can find a new normal in a new everyday life. So it's very important to help the families to rebuild these relationships. And this is why that we have developed this project called Calm Together. And it's with specific activities that helps the children and their adults to be together in a way where they are finding ease and safety together. Because for a lot of people that has been through a difficult time and stressful events like crisis and war, it is very difficult to find just this calmness in their body again. And especially if you have children with you, it can sometimes be even more difficult to find the calmness in the family because you're maybe focusing on what is happening with your family back home and how your life is going to be in Denmark and what the future brings. So these activities are actually a way of trying to help the families to find that calmness in the family unit again, and to also laugh and have fun and to be reminded that this is a really important place for you to be in the family. So it has been really interesting to try to help the volunteers to help the families in a more specific way. In Denmark, we have been very focused on learning language and learning to get a job and to be active in your community. And that's obviously quite important for a new refugee coming to Denmark. But we saw that we also needed to focus more on this child aspect, because children are taking up more space in the social activities, and it's also taking up space in a way where it's important for the volunteers to know how to handle the children and how to make a good, safe space for them, both for the children but also for the families.
And how do you do that? How do you ensure that the volunteers, they have the knowledge and they have the tools to engage in this program?
Yeah. First of all, in a way, it's a little bit of an education of our volunteers, because a lot of the volunteers we have in Denmark or in Danish Red Cross are elderly, many of them. So they have been working with these young men coming for quite a long time. So it's a small step trying to make them open up to this fact of involving children, and also trying to see how to actually help them to see it themselves. You know, you can't force the volunteers to say, okay, I want to work with children, or I want to make this family focus a main thing in our activities. So it's a small way of starting to talk about it and starting to help them to see what is happening in the social activities in the local branches. And also they themselves are starting to address that they need tools to handle the families and children in a new way. We have, of course, been working with children through other programs, like buddy programs and family programs. But it is a new thing that we are seeing them in our local branches' social activities, like the cafes and meeting points and so on. So first of all, it's awareness. And then some of them, they have asked for tools. And in the local branches where they have asked specifically for help and support to support the children, We have developed this program, and then we visit them and train them in how to do the exercises so they feel comfortable about it. And we talk with them about how to support the families and the children. So it's sort of a three-step rocket that is slowly working.
It's no secret that had we made this interview 1 year ago, it would have been a completely different interview. The war in Ukraine, of course, has changed so much. Can you elaborate a little bit on what has been the changes in the work in the Danish Red Cross when working with children and their mental health after the conflict in Ukraine?
Yeah, it has changed quite a lot after the conflict in Ukraine. So from 2015 to 2017, we had so many Syrians coming, and obviously it was often young men and very resourceful men who had the strength to get all the way to Denmark as a destination country. And then a few years after, the family followed with family reunifications and so on. And in that way, a lot of our work was mainly focused on the unaccompanied minors coming here to Denmark, and then on the families when they were reunified. So the work was mainly on how to support the adults to get a livelihood, to learn the language, to get a job, and all these, important things. But for a long time in Denmark, the main focus has been to integrate the adults, and then the children would follow. Of course, they have been included in schools and so on, but not as carefully in a way as we do it now. So now we see that because so many children is part of the adults' life when they come to Denmark, there has been this change in how we structure things in the local branches. So it has been quite a change, actually. And that's why it's also for us a learning process. So further back, we used to have a lot more focus on the children activities. But now it's really a first thing, because the children are there. So we need to know how to make sure that they are safe and protected, and that they are also getting support to deal with the reactions and feelings of crisis that they have on a daily basis. And another thing is that we also see that a lot of children, they find it difficult to integrate. Or, well, some do it really easily and they are not a problem or a challenge as such. But we also see that some children are finding it really difficult to integrate in the Danish system, in the school system, and to learn the language and so on.
And what would you say have been the biggest challenges in this change?
The biggest challenge has definitely been to sort of work with the volunteers in a way that they were ready to receive the children. Because if we're, I mean, for so many years, the main focus has really been to help with job and application and language and these things directed very much on the labor market. And they have somehow been very specialized in doing that. So we are well facing that we need to recruit new volunteers who actually really want to work with children. But also our volunteers, they are asking for new tools because they can see how important it is to support the families in all the activities, not just the family-related activities. So that is a major change. I think a lot of our volunteers, they're really trying to go about this in a natural way and also a clever way. But also we need to be very careful of how to support them, not putting too much extra weight on their shoulders and so on. Yeah.
So you said a few times that the volunteers, they keep asking for new tools to work with children and the mental health. Now I'm asking you. So what are those tools? I mean, what can volunteers do to support children and their mental health?
Yeah. Actually, the volunteers often do it themselves. So often it's actually more about highlighting when they do it and how they do it and how they can maybe change a little bit so that they create even more security, for instance. Of course, I think a lot of our volunteers are well aware that they do psychosocial support, but they are maybe not so aware of how to address it specifically. So that is what we help them to do when we create programs like Come Together. We tell them how they can make sure to make a safe space for the children, what security actually means, how important it is with stability and clear frames for an activity and for social community. So all these things that we often know on in our mental mind, but are not so focused on how to do. That's the things that we're trying to help the volunteers to see and to also address. So it has often to do with like how you verbalize it and also help them to verbalize it, making sure that there's stability around them and making sure that the volunteers are also calm when they enter a space with children and families, because often that calmness will just affect the community as a whole. So sometimes it has something to do with just expressing how you as a volunteer enter a room. And that's actually a little funny way because it's more like small micro skills that you need to work with as a volunteer.
And so I can understand that it's been quite a journey, but what would you say has been the main takeaways?
Yeah, the main takeaway has been how amazing the volunteers already work and adjust to these new settings. They are really good at finding the new normal where they are aware of the children and so on, but also how little it takes to help them to do it even better. These things about being calm and being present, they have always been aware of that, but by addressing it and emphasizing it, it's easier for them also to say, okay, this is what we do in our activities. We are being present, helping the adults to be present with the children and so on. Another really important learning has been how important it is to talk about healthy limits for the volunteers and their own self-care. Because obviously the volunteers in Denmark, they are carrying quite a heavy load now because we have so many newly arrived refugees in Denmark. So they need to also take care of themselves and also make sure that they don't get too occupied with supporting children. And often, I mean, aspects with children, they go in a little bit deep. So this whole protecting your own limits, making sure that you have a healthy, safe space yourself as a volunteer. It has been so important to address. So the self-care for volunteer and the training of them to leave things behind, even though it's children, that is a challenge, but it's also been really important to do that more explicitly.
Will it change the way that the Danish Red Cross work with children and the mental health of children in migration and moving forward?
It definitely will. Danish Red Cross have now changed the way we look at children and their mental health as part of supporting the family. And we will continue to develop that because we see more families coming and we also see families living together with other families. And we need to help them to do that in a healthy way. So we are developing our focus to work more specifically with the mental health in the families and how to help our volunteers to do that in a better way.
Thank you very much for participating in this podcast.
Thank you.
That was Christel Voldby Winter explaining how Danish Red Cross work to support the mental well-being of children in migration. You probably noticed Christel mentioning that one of the tools the Danish Red Cross is training volunteers in utilizing is how to create a safe space for children. But what does that mean? How do you do that? It so happens that in the IFSC Psychosocial Center, we have an expert in creating child-friendly spaces. Technical advisor Ia Susanna Akasha has assisted Red Cross, Red Crescent National Societies creating child-friendly spaces all over the world. And I invited her for an interview to tell both how you set up, but also how you manage a child-friendly space. And my first question to her was, what is a child-friendly space?
A child-friendly space is something we set up in emergencies or in any disaster situation where there's, for instance, no schools, where schools are destroyed, they're closed, or we can set them up as after-school activities for children. But we don't set up and run child-friendly spaces in competition with schools because children need their education.
So what is the difference between a school and a child-friendly space?
Well, a school follows a formal curricula for each class, whereas a child-friendly space is an area, a space where children can come, they can socialize, they can play, they can learn, they can be together, they can have different activities, and everything can be run for different age groups at the same time. So it's also a place and a space where children come together of different ages, of different backgrounds, where they are taught simple things or where they learn about basic being together, following rules, social emotional learning, as we call it, or transferable skills. So they learn about being a good friend. They can have these small sessions where they learn different activities that all have a psychosocial component. And besides that, they can do free play and they can do games together. They can do Lego. They can do all kind drawing. They can have an aunt from the community or a caregiver who comes and sit and reads to them. So there will be many different activities that can take place according to the needs in a child-friendly space.
And when does it make sense to set up a child-friendly space?
Well, in any emergency, when schools, for instance, if you're thinking of a flooding, so schools will be closed because they're flooded and children don't have anything to do. And we know that structured activities taking place at the same time, daily or maybe biweekly or weekly, that's very important for children. And another thing that we also need to incorporate into a child-friendly space is this thinking about children need to keep the ability to learn intact, and they learn and they can keep on learning by learning. So we can do different kind of activities that have this kind of learning element in them. It can be games. They learn through games. They learn and then we discuss the games with them. Or they can do different kind of role plays where they learn new things. So that's a very important element in the child-friendly space and the reason that they're set up.
If you're a staff or volunteer in a Red Cross, Red Crescent National Societies, and there is an emergency context and you see the need to set up a child-friendly space, concretely, what do you do?
Well, there are some guides and some guidelines. So first of all staff in the National Society needs to be trained on the safeguarding child safeguarding policy of the IFRC. That's number one. Then in the different materials, the Peer Centre has produced a guide, guidelines for setting up, establishing and running child-friendly spaces. You have all the things you need to be aware about and how you can do it. Finally, there's an online training that we have made, which is an introduction that you can do online. There's a workbook that you can do where you can write down and do all the tasks that you're asked to do, because we will say during the training, now pause the video and go to your worksheet or workbook. So this is a prerequisite for running a child-friendly space that volunteer staff are trained in the child protection policy or child safeguarding policy, that they know about children, that they know how to support children, and that they know about all these basic guidelines from international agencies about how to set up the child-friendly space.
And I'll be sure to leave links in the show notes to the trainings and the training videos. But I'm still thinking, okay, so we have guides on how to set up a child-friendly space, and then what? I guess you also need guidance in how to run the child-friendly space.
Yeah, that's part of what we cover in the online training and part of what is in the manuals. And there's also examples of how you can design your own sessions, short sessions with an open, with a main exercise and with a group closure. And there are sessions that you can just take off the manual and use them, and they're quite successful. I've seen them many places. We also have the Children's Resilience Program, which has many, many sessions for children where you can also pick and choose. Plus, we have the Happy Healthy Toolkit, which is a manual that's originally designed for teachers. And it has loads of 16 sessions, actually, with exercises that you can do with children in a child-friendly space. And these exercises are all based on social emotional learning, or what we call the training children or for children to learn transferable skills that they can use in their daily life. And I can give you an example. Once in a program, there was an evaluation done, and it was in a remote area. And the man who was interviewed about how he saw the program said, "We're very happy about the houses we've been given. We've been given food. We've been given non-food items. But the best thing is that actually our children learn some skills that they will keep for a lifetime."
I would like to return to the question of setting up the child-friendly space, because emergencies can be many different things, and the context can differ from region to region and from emergency to emergency. Typically, where would you set up a child-friendly space?
Oh, that's a brilliant question. So, for instance, you would have maybe, in the current situation in Europe, you would have shelters. And a child-friendly space is not just a corner with some toys. That's really important. It's organized, it's structured, it is run by volunteers, there's a schedule, people know when to come and what to expect. So there could be a corner in a shelter. There could be a corner in a transit area where people are transiting. But this is defined area. It needs to be protected so that it's safe for children to come and to be there. And you can have other emergencies when the schools are flooded, where you have maybe another area under a tree where you can have this kind of activities. But of course, again, you need to be safe and you need to have sort of an enclosed area where the children can be.
How do you make sure that these child-friendly spaces are safe?
Yeah, safety is really important. So it's important to find a good location. You have to, in some areas, you have to think about unexploded ordnance and mines. And if that's the case, of course, you put that as part of what you do with the children. Teach them how to recognize mines or other unexploded ordnance and not to touch it. So it could be a house. It could be in a library. It could be in a school. If for some reason there's no schools, it could be in an underground shelter. It can be in all kinds of places, but it needs to be a very clearly marked area for children where they can feel they can unfold, they can relax, they can socialize and interact.
It sounds to me that it also requires some resources in terms of manpower.
You're right. And there is actually, there's a recommendation to how many adults or volunteers you need per group of children. And that's very important. And also that, as I said before, that the staff and volunteers are trained and that they are supervised, that they can get questions if they have difficult cases or they want to refer somebody, that they know how to make safe referrals, that they know how to collaborate with caregivers. So there's a lot of things that needs to be in place. So it's not just, as I said, a corner where you place some toys. That's not a child-friendly space.
Now, we mentioned that you can find resources online and both in guidelines but also training videos. Is that enough, or do you need some more formal training?
So we created this online training to give staff and volunteers a basic introduction to be sure that the work that they're doing is safe for children and for caregivers and for the volunteers themselves. But if volunteers are well trained in mental health and psychosocial support, that's a very good idea because it does give them the advantage of knowing how to interact. They know psychological first aid, so they know how to support a child if and the need should arise. We've run trainings in child-friendly spaces. Many national societies do run them. And I think that you would call it a starting point, and then you would need more support locally if you want to set up a child-friendly space.
Yeah, you have seen child-friendly spaces around the world.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that you've seen both good and bad examples. Try to describe a good example and why it's a good example.
Yeah. Once there was a child-friendly space at specific times in a community center after a big flooding in a country in Southeast Asia where I worked. And the most amazing thing was actually that the children would learn things. They could learn about floods. That's a very obvious thing if you're in a flood. Then you teach children about floods, what to be aware of, what to watch out for, not to drink the flood water, et cetera, et cetera. Basic things that they may not necessarily know. But the great thing was that they went home and they taught their entire families. We would do a warm-up with them in the morning. The entire family would then be taught to do that warm-up. We would train them in knowing because it was also an earthquake-prone zone. So children are really, when they get enthusiastic and they learn things, that they also want to transmit the message. So it was really a great way of getting the whole community engaged. And the other activities around this community center also supported you could have groups. We would have groups with caregivers where they were taught and discussed children's well-being, and where they learned and could discuss how do we deal with children when they behave differently after an emergency. So this comprehensive approach, when you have a child-friendly space included in other MHPS activities. After big emergencies, that's fantastic.
Yeah, earlier I spoke to Crystal from Danish Red Cross about how Danish Red Cross had to redirect focus from giving support to young men to, after the conflict in Ukraine, focus on families with children and the challenges they were facing. I can imagine for a national society, for the first time, setting up a child-friendly space, there would be some obvious pitfalls.
Actually, it's quite straightforward. If you go through all the materials, if you read it, if you study it, it's really easy. And it's written in very and online training. It's done very accessible ways. It's not complicated. And I think that you need to think of different age groups require different things. So if you make a child-friendly space, say you're in a shelter, or an asylum department, in a house for asylum seekers, you would naturally make activities for the different age groups. You would also want to do something for teenagers, and you would want to do something for caregivers, and you would want to do something for the grannies. So you can use all these groups. You can engage the community in the child-friendly space. So you can have the grannies come and tell stories in the child-friendly space about when they were young. They can sit and read stories to the children, small groups of children. You can have the caregivers discuss amongst themselves what do they do to maintain their psychosocial well-being, how can they support their children. So it's all about thinking not only of the child-friendly space, but a child-friendly space as a part of what you're doing for the community that's affected.
That's an important point. Thank you, Aya, for enlightening us and enlightening me about child-friendly spaces.
You're so welcome.
That was Aya Susanna Akasha telling us about child-friendly spaces. In my last interview, we will return to academia. The IFSC Psychosocial Center is always engaged in several research projects partnering with universities and research institutes to develop new and innovative tools to give psychosocial support to vulnerable groups. One of these projects are called REFUJET. The REFUJET project aims to develop effective practices in education, mental health and psychosocial support for the integration of refugee children. Teresa Sodemati is a professor of sociology at the Autonomous University and she is the principal investigator of the REFUJET project. Earlier, I called her and asked her to explain the aim and scope of REFUJET.
The REFUJET project is funded under the Horizon 2020 project, so it's a three-year project. And our main aim is to promote this dynamic integration through education and MHPSS among minors of migrant descent from any cohort. And we are also considering unaccompanied minors, refugees, and asylum seekers. The type of activities that we are engaging in is we have in the first phase of the project and drawing from previous experiences of very well-known and experienced partners like Red Cross, the PSC Center at the Red Cross, MHPSS Collaborative under the Save the Children Denmark, and the Site of Education, the UAB team under the and the University of Firenze, for instance. I mean, we all have collaborated in different previous projects identifying effective practices, both in education and MHPSS. So our main goal under the REFUJET project is to take on these effective practices that have showed to be already highly effective in promoting this dynamic integration among minors and bringing it to new settings. So we are working with refugee camps, formal education. We are working in a total of 46 pilots across Europe in six different countries in formal, non-formal, and informal education settings.
And you mentioned effective practices. What are these effective practices?
In the effective practices, we have started with the educational ones, and this is what was identified under the FP6 included project as successful educational actions. These are actions that have proven, as mentioned, we have evidence that the scientific evidence and solid evidence that they work in very different fields and with very different constituencies, and which are effective in promoting this dynamic integration. For instance, we are working with a way of arranging the classroom among all the resources that are available in the community in terms of teaching staff and volunteers from the community. Volunteers are coming into the classroom and we are arranging the educational activities in small groups, promoting the interactions among heterogeneous groups. So even if we have a migrant, a newly arrived migrant who has, who is not speaking the home language, this student will be also included in these interactive groups, and it will be through this interaction and with the support of community members or other teaching staff that these learners are achieving the same outcomes than the rest of the students, for instance. We are also working on family education programs who have been very much implemented in many different parts of the world. And we're also, for instance, promoting the dialogic gatherings, considering like the best creations of humanity in terms of classical literature, classical music, arts and science, for instance, this knowledge that is considered to be only accessible for very highly educated people. And we are bringing this knowledge into all the communities and through a circle, a dialogic reading circle or dialogic discussion circle, we are bringing these best creations of humanity to anyone.
And can you explain a little bit more about the process of this project and how far you are?
Yeah, actually, we are finalizing the second year of the refugee project. And as it is mandatory in all the Horizon 2020 projects, we have engaged in a co-creation process with the communities. So the co-creation happens when we, after a needs analysis that we conducted during the first year in all 46 pilot sites, we engage in a co-creation process, bringing in these effective practices to the communities. And each pilot site has decided which practices they will be implementing, when, how, in which ways they will have recreated these educational practices, these successful educational practices in their own context. At the moment, we are providing the training in many of these pilot sites, and in others, they have already started to implementing. At the same time, we are evaluating all this process, not only the co-creation process, but also the outcome evaluation with a series of tools that we have developed under the consortium.
And what is the expected outcome?
The expected outcome, besides the improvements and the social impact that we are aiming to achieve in improving the dynamic integration of all the minors who are participating in these pilot sites and the communities, because we take a community approach. So we do not only work with professionals, we do not only work with students and minors, but we are also working with the families if they are there, of course. And the final outcome, besides the improvements that we will gather and that we will prove that are taking place in the different pilot sites, we will produce a brokering knowledge platform in which all the materials and all the information that has been produced throughout the project will be made available to anyone who want to transfer and who apply and implement these successful educational practices, and the same procedure with the MHPSS practices.
I read on the Refugee website that you call this project innovative. So what is the innovative aspect of this project?
The innovative process is to bring all these scientific-based and tested effective practices to other communities that are not implementing them. So, for instance, we are innovating in the case of Spain. We are working with unaccompanied minor centers, the emergency centers, where the unaccompanied minors who cross the border in Melilla or in the south of Spain are distributed along across the country. So, and these are centers that maybe these minors are only there for weeks or for a month. So we are already, for instance, implementing dialogic literary gatherings in these settings. So they are exposed to the language, but also we are promoting many other learnings, including the MHPSS site, because we are creating and promoting this type of safe interaction among all them, for instance. It is also innovated in terms of working in refugee camps. For instance, in the case of Sweden, we are working with Save the Children and a refugee-led organization, the Support Group Network, and we are working within the refugee camp, for instance, of Restegard in Vanesbury, in a cultural center which is run by the same refugees. We are also implementing these dialogic literary gatherings there, and we are also working on family education and other successful educational actions. Of course, in the what follows, the MHPSS part will be implemented, because it is also a really very important part of the refugee project.
And what has been the part of the IFSC Psychosocial Center in this project?
Well, the PSC Center is bringing in all their experience in providing training to all the volunteers and people involved in the Red Cross network. So we are replicating in a sense or recreating this experience and this expertise within the consortium, like, for instance, providing MHPSS training. We are organizing a training the trainer within the consortium, so all the implementing partners will be able to replicate and to train in their pilot sites, but they will be also providing some training directly to the pilot sites. So this is one part of the expertise and the role that the PSC Center is playing within the refugee project. And on the other hand, the PSC Center is the one in who will have a leading role in designing and producing this knowledge, brokering knowledge platform at the end.
Thank you very much, Teresa, for participating in this podcast. I thought it was very, very interesting.
No, thank you, Jesper.
You've been listening to Heartbeat of Humanity, a podcast series for Red Cross, Red Crescent movement staff and volunteers about mental health and psychosocial support. In this episode, we have explored how we, as humanitarians, can give mental health and psychosocial support to children in migration. I have talked to Orso Monegina, head of the Global Program Expert Group on Mental Health and Psychosocial Support in SOS Children's Villages International, Christel Volby Winter, Program Manager of Mental Health in the Migration and Refugee Section in the National Department of Danish Red Cross, Ia Susanna Akasha, MSPSS Technical Advisor in the IFSC Psychosocial Center, and Therese Sodemati, Professor of Sociology at the Autonomous University and Principal Investigator of the Refugee Project. You can find more resources about mental health and psychosocial support on the IFSC Psychosocial Center website. Resources include manuals, webinars, policy documents, program materials, educational videos, and information about upcoming trainings. My name is Jesper Gule, and I hope you enjoyed listening to this Heartbeat of Humanity podcast. Remember that mental health matters.